17th of June. Boy, that's my date for signing up. 17th of January.
Mr. Chair, is that a prediction?
That's a good prediction,
don't you think? And we are about to venture into troubled waters this afternoon. We're going to have an informational meeting only. There'll be no public testimony as indicated in the agenda scheduled for this meeting. The presentations will be from the invited testimony, Department of Human Resources, Oregon Dental Association, League of Oregon Cities, and Oregon Cities for Safe Drinking Water. And with that, if you have some instructions for us, Sandy, before we begin.
I have nothing to share.
You have nothing to share? Okay. Thank you. Then would call Catherine Bradley, PhD and RN from the Office of Family Health. And do you have anybody that wants to be there with you or you're a solo?
No, actually.
Good afternoon.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. I've invited Dave Leland from the Water Department of the Department of Health Services to also join me today. For the record, my name is Catherine Bradley. I am the administrator of the Office of Family Health with the Department of Human Services. I want to speak today in response to House Bill 2025, which is requiring water suppliers to serve more than 10,000 persons to add fluoride to their drinking water. The department is providing testimony this morning to give you sort of an overview, a brief framework on water fluoridation, data from an oral health survey that we conducted on the Children's Oral Health of Oregon, and some estimated cost impacts of this bill that had been done by the water department. As you well know, the goal of community water fluoridation is to reach an optimal fluoride concentration, and its goal is for the prevention of tooth decay. From a public health perspective, this is generally viewed as part of a population-based strategy and works at the prevention and control of tooth decay in communities. It's also viewed as a very equitable approach in terms of drinking water will affect all ages, regardless of race, gender, ethnicity, or income level. In 1962, the U.S. Public Health Service made a recommendation that all community drinking waters should contain 0.7 to 1.2 parts per million of fluoride, and that's the objective and the goal according to the Public Health Service. The Office of Family Health, with the Department of Health Services, has a very active health program across the state of Oregon and has many community partners in which we're engaged with. We have a number of initiatives. The primary one that we're predominantly focused on these days is an early childhood cavity prevention program. So we work very heavily with our community and our school partners in terms of working with school-aged children in both primary and secondary schools. But the real emphasis is in the primary schools in terms of education and teaching and then dental sealant activities. We're also part of a statewide planning initiative that is developing a statewide oral health plan, and we are also part of a fluoridation system development initiative. So there's a lot of work that's currently going on across the state in terms of looking at what the statewide needs are for oral health and where we need to do some planning for the future. We also, in the department, have the statewide drinking program, which deals with Safe Water Acts, which I'll speak to shortly. In 2001, for the first time, we were actually able to conduct a survey of the children of Oregon and get some sense of the children's oral health. Yes, sir.
Representative, this is your bill, I believe, one that you introduced, and I'm curious if you would like to make opening comments on it before we get further in the testimonies, or if at any time you'd like to make opening comments.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity. I don't think I'll comment, but I do appreciate you getting to the issue as quickly as you have, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Please excuse me. Go ahead.
Quite all right, Chair. The survey that we conducted in 2001 is known as the SMILE survey, and it was conducted with first, second, and third graders across all 36 counties in Oregon. We actually were able to train dental assistants, and they actually went into the schools and, with the parents' permission, actually did an oral survey of children's health. And so that was the results that we have from that. Told us that 57% of Oregon children have experienced tooth decay. Now, how that compares nationally is that approximately 52% of the nation have children in the nation have experienced tooth decay, and the overall goal is 47%. So that gives you a 42%, excuse me. So that what we're at right now is 57% for Oregon children. The other thing is that what we have found is that children of color and poor children have a significantly higher decay problem than the general population. Specifically, poor children in Oregon are more likely to have three times as many problems with tooth decay than not. Approximately 20% of Oregons, as you well know, actually receive optimally fluoridated water, and so part of that is felt to be the impact in the community of the lack of fluoridation. The goal for Healthy People 2010, which is sort of a public health standard, is that 75% of the population by 2010 will actually have fluoridated drinking water. So that gives you a sense that here in Oregon, with 20% of our population actually having optimally fluoridated water, and the impact on our children currently is that we do have a higher cavity, a higher percentage of cavities, and that it adversely affects children of color and poor children. The drinking water program per se does have established water safety standards that are dictated through the Safe Drinking Water Act and the Oregon Safer Drinking Water Act. What we did ask is we asked our department to do some estimated cost impacts of this bill. We do recognize these are minimal cost impacts, and the information is focused simply on the cost of the basic feed equipment and then the annual cost of chemicals. It also does not affect all communities because of the communities surveyed that are 10,000 or more. Approximately 23 of those communities currently do have fluoridated water. So of those communities, yes, sir.
In relationship to those communities that and those that you're citing here, if we talk about the 57% of children in Oregon, what's the percent of children in those communities? Do you have that data?
I do not, but I will have it for you by Wednesday.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. Didn't mean to interrupt your thought.
Representative, can I ask a question?
Yeah, actually, thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you clarify that again? How many communities that meet that threshold do have local fluoridation?
The review of the department, approximately 23 of the communities will not be impacted by this bill because they have fluoridation.
So leaving, if I may follow up.
Follow up.
Leaving how many communities it would be, do we know?
We'll count that number up for you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I would like all this data that you're rattling off, I would like to be given to me.
All right.
So I don't have to scratch it down trying to remember it.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. Representative Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And also, while we're doing that, could you, if the information is readily available on the one-page fact sheet you're going to put together for us, could you give us an indication of what it might cost, what any estimates are for those local communities that would be affected by this to be able to, prepare that infrastructure?
The minimum estimates that we had at this time are that for the water fluoridation equipment, it would be $2.8 million, and this is on the testimony, and then the cost of fluoride chemicals is $1.3 million. That's an annual cost, and that is for those two components.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I'm sorry, was that for the entire, system-wide for these cities that don't have the fluoridation, or is it per water system?
If I may ask my colleague, Dave Leland, from the Water Department, he may speak to that more specifically.
Okay. As Chair Jansen and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Leland, and I'm the manager of the drinking water program for the Department of Human Services. The cost estimates that we prepared are, as was said earlier, just the basic cost for feed equipment and a year's worth of chemical costs. So they're limited there to just really the very minimal costs. And there would be other costs that communities would have to look at themselves. But just to give you a couple numbers that I worked up while I was listening here, that would be about 29 communities that do not currently add fluoride. There are over 10,000 people. And then the cost estimate of that was mentioned earlier is for those communities to do their basic feed equipment and the chemical costs.
Thank you. If I might follow up, you know, I had conversations with some folks in the dental field that had expressed interest in the sort of theoretical possibility that they might be able to privately raise some dollars to be able to help manage the cost of any sort of infrastructure that needed to occur on those other for those cities that don't have the fluoride service. So. I just as a comment, you know, would ask you to entertain that as a possibility. What sort of structure could what that could look like if you had private interest that wanted to help manage some of that cost, particularly for some of the smaller smaller entities that or cities or whatever that that needed to help manage some of that cost. So something to explore. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Let me look at these costs that you have here just briefly for clarification in my mind. This is a statewide cost as far as the $2.8 million. It is not a community cost. There is the assumption being made here that the state is going to fund this, or is the assumption being made that the local communities will be funding this?
Chair Jensen and members of the committee, these are simply the costs for the communities that don't currently fluoridate, that are serve over 10,000 people, what those minimum costs would be from whatever source of funding that it comes from.
We have, 29 communities?
Yes, sir.
Do we have any breakdown of the per community cost? Have those figures been put together for us?
Chair Jensen, yes, we have done that, and Brian will get that to you.
We would appreciate having those. Thank you.
Can I have a follow-up?
Follow-up, representing. Oh.
Thank you. Mr. Leland, as a follow-up to that, I'm assuming that the state isn't paying for cost of fluoridation in the communities that currently have it?
Representative Dingfelder, that is correct.
So yes. What would be helpful is, and maybe we can even have the city of Salem come and testify, but obviously the ratepayers, it's passed on to the ratepayers, and be interested to see how the communities are paying for that and how that would compare to the per capita cost that you've identified here. Maybe you can get us that information, or, Mr. Chair, we could have somebody from the City of Salem's Water Department come and provide us with an example of a city that's providing fluoridation, what the costs are to the ratepayers, and spread among thousands of ratepayers in Salem.
Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder, I think that's an excellent point. The communities that fluoridate now do recover their costs from the ratepayers. And I think Salem would be an excellent example. Salem is actually the largest water supplier in Oregon that adds fluoride. Another suggestion that I'd give you is Beaverton, since they just started in the past year. So they've constructed an entire new facility, and they have I think some very good cost figures that they could provide to the committee.
Thank you.
Are some of these communities that are using fluoride now, they're less than 10,000 in population?
Yes, Chair Jensen, Representative Brown, yes, some of them are smaller, and we have a list of those communities actually on our website. But we'll provide that to you.
Thank you.
Representative
Barnhart. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This, I think, is a continuing follow-up. Can you let us know how many people
will actually be affected by this bill. Changing, that is going from systems that are not fluoridated now, but that would be, assuming the bill were to be passed. That would be helpful.
Chair Jensen, Representative Barnard, we'll get that to you as well. Yes, we have that all broken down.
Representative Shoffler.
I don't know if you have the answer to this question or not, but like in my water district, Sunrise Water Authority, it's Mount Scott and Damascus combined, but they actually adjust the amount of fluoride in the water that you get out of a couple of wells. Are there any other examples of communities that have to do that, that do fluoridate, and would that make a difference in how much it costs as far as providing it for everyone? Because it would just be, they would have to add less in, I'd imagine. Is there any other examples like that?
Chair Jensen, Representative Shoffler, yes, and that's true really for any community that adds fluoride. Fluoride is present in all waters at some level. It's a component of the Earth's crust. It's a natural element. It's everywhere. And in each case, any community that fluoridates establishes what its already occurring level of fluoride is, and then only adds the incremental amount to get to the optimum dose.
Please, I'm sorry for the interruption. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. I think that fairly closely summarizes. I think the only component in summary that I did want to mention is that while we do recognize the value of fluoridation, we also recognize that the costs to implement this initiative are significant in this year's legislative cycle and the challenges in front of the legislature in terms of general funds, and therefore we're not, as a department, taking an official position on this at this time. But we're more than happy to work with the committee in terms of providing background information that is needed to more fully inform you in your decision.
Thank you. I think there's been a number. Representative, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have a question that just kind of popped into my brain, if I may ask it.
Please, if you would.
Thank you. Can you provide us with, and actually web links would probably be just fine, but can you provide us with some listing, and maybe this has already been asked, of some of the double-blind studies that have been done and with regards to fluoridation. I think one of the charges that are probably going to be made by the folks that are against fluoridation is that research information that's out there is based on opinion and not based on fact. And I think that, you know, one of the simplest or easiest ways to get to sort of that that argument is our double-blind studies that have been done that show whether or not fluoridation has been effective, and also what the optimal levels of fluoridation in water is. I know in your testimony you said something about it being 0.7 to 1.2 parts per million.
Correct.
With regards to the water. So it'd be interesting to see what kind of double blind studies are out there that have shown this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Good point. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That reminds me that I was going to ask another question. Presuming we're getting near the end of Dr. Bradley's presentation today. We received a notebook from the Citizens for Safe Drinking Water, which is at the beginning of it has a letter, a several-page letter that ends with several items that are provided in bullet points. And it would be, I think, helpful for the committee in its deliberations if we had a response, if there is a response to the bullet points contained at the end of that letter.
Chair Jensen, Representative Barnhart, I'm not familiar with that, but we'll take a look at it. There is considerable evidence that is scientific evidence that we can provide you with the specifics that there has not been an indication to date that there are adverse effects on health for humans or for our environment with the natural fluoride that incurs. But clearly you need to have that data in front of you and readily accessible, and we can respond to that notebook as well.
There are specific claims on that point and some other points in this letter, and it would be useful, I think, to have your response, whether you agree with that or disagree with that, and what the basis for that agreement or disagreement would be. Thank you, sir.
Yes.
Thank you.
Chair Jensen and Representative Barnhart, we'd be very pleased to do that. It is a considerable challenge, I think, trying to wade through what is opinion and what is good science. And we're all at that place nowadays where I think we're getting a better understanding of what truly is the good science and how that can inform us.
Any other questions for Dr. Bradley? Thank you very much, and we'll look forward to getting the other information that you've been asked about today.
We look forward to providing it.
By our Wednesday meeting, if possible.
Yes.
Thank you. At this point, we have Jane Myers with the Oregon Dental Association. And you have Dr. Tempest, is that right, coming with you too?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jane Myers, Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Dental Association. And with me today is Dr. Bill Tempest, who is the a member of the Oregon Dental Association and senior vice president, right, Bill, for the Oregon ODS companies in Portland. I think we'll let Dr. Tempest start, and then I'll take up the part about safety.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. My name is Bill Tempest. I was previously served as the president of the American Dental Association. I'm familiar with fluoride for many years because I grew up in Corvallis that has fluoridated their water for many years. In fact, six of my family, the siblings, four of them grew up without fluoridation and have numerous restorations. Two grew up with fluoride and have no restorations. The Oregon Dental Association represents 75% of the dentists delivering services in Oregon. We support community water fluoridation. We're here today to give you as much insight as possible about the need to take a big step toward prevention of tooth decay for Oregon's children and adults. The fact that optimal water fluoridation prevents tooth decay is widely known and well supported by generally accepted science. Like vaccinations and school checkups, water fluoridation is a part of our nation's health agenda for nearly 60 years. It has been frequently studied and found by researchers and public health officials over and over again to be a safe and effective way to reduce tooth decay. Every U.S. Surgeon General since 1950 has endorsed the benefits of community water fluoridation. In addition, fluoridation is not costly to implement and benefits all residents served by community water supplies, regardless of their social economic status. While some experts may disagree over the exact percentage of tooth decay reduction, it is clear that over the last six decades, the use of fluoride has resulted in significant savings in oral health care costs and reduced a lot of needless suffering from tooth decay. How much money? According to a study in April 2002 of the Journal of the Dental Research, water fluoridation has saved nearly $40 billion in dental care costs over the past 40 years. Other recent research by the Centers for Disease Control shows that each dollar invested in fluoridation saves $38 in dental care costs. Unfortunately, only about 20% of Oregonians drink fluoridated water. Oregon ranks 48 out of 50 states in terms of percentage of citizens who have access to the important health benefit. What this means in simple terms is that dental decay is a significant problem for children of Oregon. Smile Survey 2002 by the Oregon Department of Human Services Oral Health Section shows that nearly 6 out of 10 children suffer from tooth decay. Children are affected by this disease early and continue to experience decay at greater rates as they grow older. Children in the survey aged 6 to 8 had caries rate of 56%. However, this rate jumps to 63% after 9 years of age. The story gets worse for children from low-income families in Oregon, where the SMILE survey shows that the poor children were three times more likely to have untreated decay compared to children of eligible and non-eligible for federal school free and reduced priced meal program. It is not hard to see how adult oral health conditions can be traced back to the childhood diseases, nor is it difficult to understand the serious impact the state's budget for dental care under programs like the Oregon Health Plan. One of the foundations of Oregon Health Plan is emphasis on preventing disease. Budget constraints are making prevention more and more difficult to achieve, and many of us, dental and medical professionals alike, think there will never be a better time to speak up to the legislature and encourage you to take the steps necessary to bring more community water fluoridation to the people of our state. Less prevention means more cost and dental restorations. Oral disease affects the health of the individual. We know that children with dental decay miss school more often than those that do not have. We know that adults with disease miss more work, and we know that many health conditions are linked to dental disease. Such diseases as diabetes, heart disease, health of the pregnant women and newborn. The Oregon Health Policy Commission took this matter to heart and requested House Bill 2025, which requires water fluoridation by water suppliers serving more than 10,000 people. The Joint Interim Committee on Health and Human Services, co-chaired by Representative Dalto, took a great step forward by introducing the bill. The legislature's willingness to give serious consideration to water fluoridation is another step we hope will ultimately lead to the increase in oral health for our citizens.
I'm going to address the safety of water fluoridation. Fluoride, as many of you know, is nature's cavity fighter, and it occurs naturally in the Earth's crust in combination with other minerals in rocks and soil. Small amounts occur naturally in all water sources. Fluoridation is the physical addition of optimal amounts of fluoride to drinking water to prevent tooth decay. And optimal refers to the level established by the U.S. Public Health Service for maximum effectiveness and ranges from 0.7 to 1.2 parts per million. And to avoid any confusion, sometimes you will see this referred to by some of the documents as 1 milligram per liter, written as a 1 mg/L, and that's identical to 1 part per million. 1 part per million is the equivalent of 1 inch in 16 miles or 1 minute in 2 years. The optimal range of 0.7 to 1.2 parts per million effectively reduces tooth decay while minimizing the occurrence of dental fluorosis. The United States Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, is the federal body responsible for regulating the levels of fluoride and other substances in drinking water. They do that under the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. The Act prohibits EPA from requiring the addition of any substance, including fluoride, to drinking water for preventive health purposes. The states and local authorities determine whether or not to fluoridate their water supply. It would take an act of Congress to change the Safe Drinking Water Act. The EPA's current enforceable federal primary standard for fluoride in drinking water is at 4 milligrams per liter. As long as this standard is not exceeded, state or local authorities determine whether or not to fluoridate. The standard was set in 1986 to protect against skeletal fluorosis and adverse health effect. In 1993, the National Research Council completed a review of fluoride toxicity and exposure data for the EPA. The report concluded that the current standard for fluoride, and that's the maximum, is of 4 milligrams per liter, is appropriate as an interim standard to protect the public health. In addition, the EPA sets a non-enforceable secondary maximum contaminant level, and this is different from their other standard, of 2 milligrams per liter to protect against objectionable dental fluorosis, which is commonly seen as tooth discoloration. These regulations apply primarily to localities where larger than normal amounts of fluoride are naturally present in the water, I think as someone on the committee referred to, due to the geology of the surrounding region. In cases where the natural fluoride content is high, these regulations require a public water system to treat their water to reduce the fluoride concentration if it exceeds the maximum contaminant level. However, none of EPA's regulations have anything to do with the optimal water fluoridation. Fluoridation to prevent tooth decay in the United States is practiced at a level of about 1 milligram per liter, a level that does not even come close to reaching, much less exceeding, the federal standard. In 1991, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services published an extensive review of the benefits and risks of fluoride. They concluded by recommending that the U.S. Public Health Service continue to support optimal fluoridation. As reported by the Centers for Disease Control's mortality and morbidity review of November 30th, 2001, the U.S. Task Force on Community Preventive Services strongly recommends, based on its systematic review of scientific studies, that community water fluoridation programs be included as part of a comprehensive population-based strategy to prevent or control tooth decay in communities. Another concern sometimes raised is the safety of the chemicals used in water fluoridation. We have a copy of a very informative paper about the manufacture of fluoride chemicals, which I will pass out to the committee, by Thomas G. Reeves, the National Fluoridation Engineer at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, dated September 2000. Reeves gets right to the point about the safety of fluoride chemicals used in the U.S. for water fluoridation, stating that they are useful byproducts of the phosphate fertilizer industry, and explains how they are manufactured. This paper debunks the absurd notion that water fluoridation means dumping industrial or hazardous waste into our drinking water. To give you a brief summary of that paper's conclusions, one quote is one of their conclusions: added to the drinking water in very small amounts, the fluoride chemicals dissociate virtually 100% into their various components, ions, and are very stable, safe, and non-toxic. These studies have consistently shown that the water fluoridation using one of the psychofluoride chemicals, silofluoride chemicals, was safe to health and effective in reducing tooth decay. The CDC notes that earlier studies studied health effects of water fluoridation where the silofluoride chemicals were used. CDC is pointing out that the scientific community does not study health effects of concentrated chemicals, since human beings do not typically ingest concentrated chemicals. Rather, scientists study the effects of treating water with optimal amounts of chemicals. CDC also concluded that concern about the impurities in the fluoride chemicals is addressed by a discussion of the standards for all chemicals used in the water treatment plant, including fluoride chemicals, that are set by the American Water Works Association, a well-respected water supply industry association. Also, the National Sanitation Foundation sets standards and does product certification for products used in the water industry, including fluoride chemicals. Standard 60 was developed by the NSFNA Consortium of Associations, including the AWWA and the American National Standards Institute. Standard 60 provides for product quality and safety assurance to prevent the addition of harmful levels of contaminants from water treatment chemicals. NSF tests the fluoride chemicals for the 11 regulated metal compounds that have an EPA maximum contaminant level. Because there is no health concern for silicates, the EPA has not set a maximum contaminant level. However, Standard 60 has a maximum allowable level, which is different than the EPA's maximum contaminant level. And its tests have shown that the silicates in water samples from public water systems are well below these levels. The standard 60 is one-tenth the level of the EPA's maximum level and is for the water as it comes out of the tap. Arsenic levels in drinking water attributable to fluoride chemicals in finished water from the fluorosilic acid have been shown to be well below the NSF's standard 60s level. There is no evidence that any of the known impurities in the fluoride chemicals have failed to meet any of these standards. 40 states have laws or regulations requiring product compliance with Standard 60. Oregon requires Standard 60 certification. And another level of protection in Oregon is the Department of Human Services Health Service Drinking Water Section, who you just heard from. So I'm going to shift back to
Dr. Costs and benefits of community water fluoridation. Direct costs vary based on the size of the community, the number of wells, and the treatment plants, amount and type of equipment and buildings, type of chemicals and personnel. We are comfortable with the range expressed in the attached table of recent fluoridation startups and the annual operating costs reported in the media. The range for startup costs is $1.19 to $14.52 per person annual operating range. Again, $1.19 to $14.52 for the startup costs, and from 13 cents to $3.54 per person for the annual operating costs. That means about $1.58 average. The cost of one surface of an amalgam averages about $95. Four or more surfaces, $165. According to the American Dental Association 2003 survey of dental fees in the Pacific region, you can judge for yourself how the cost of fluoridation compared to one of the least expensive dental restorations and the money saved in dental treatment over a lifetime is another consideration that supports water fluoridation, along with the avoidance of pain and dental disease, missed school, missed work days, and other impacts on health, as well as the loss of self-esteem and dental disease. Much evidence exists to support the effectiveness of water fluoridation as means to reduce tooth decay. Here's a quote from the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Report, May 29, 1992. The most recent national survey conducted from 1986 and 87 indicated that the prevalence of caries among children with a history of lifelong exposure to optimally fluoridated water decreased 18% when compared with the prevalence among children with no exposure to optimally fluoridated water. Prevalence decreased 25% when the analysis excluded children with any history of fluoride therapy, dietary supplements, professionally applied topical treatments. In addition, recent studies have found consistently lower caries prevalence, both in coronal and root surfaces, among adults who live in communities with optimal or greater fluoride than among those from communities with lower fluoride levels. And I would just say that in Oregon, one of six Oregonians over the age of 60 have no teeth. And with the maintenance of teeth, changes the cavity's style and root decay is now a big issue. So fluoridating also helps older Oregonians. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services continue to support the community water fluoridation as the most cost-effective, equitable, and safe means to provide protection from tooth decay in the community. As stated by the United States Surgeon General, July 28, 2004, water fluoridation is a power strategy in our efforts to eliminate differences in health among people and is consistent with my emphasis on the importance of prevention. Again, 50% of the children in the state of Oregon have decay, 25% go untreated, 61% cavity reduction with fluoridation versus without fluoridation. This is a bill that needs to be passed. It is a bill that we recommend, not because it is our bottom line. It affects our bottom line negative, but it affects the patients that we see with health and dental decay, and we believe it is necessary and timely. Thank you.
And members of the committee, I have passed out the testimony. I apologize for the copy. I didn't realize until we got here that it has some streaks where you can't read it, so we will replace the copy. But just so that you have a copy, at the back end of it is the Centers for Disease Control's letter about the safety of the chemicals used, which I think is an important consideration for the committee to have in their hands. We also have Dr. Tempest brought with him a list of the endorsing organizations, which is a three-page list. It's rather impressive about different associations and groups which support water fluoridation. If there are any questions, we'll try to respond.
Mr. Chair.
The question. Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Just for the record, my wife is a dentist, and I would have to declare a conflict of interest if I voted no on this bill, because it would be more money in my wife's business. And for the record, our little girl is taking fluoride ever since whatever age the good doctor at home said she was supposed to. So, and my question is, the missed work, the days lost from school, which means parents have to stay home if they're, not, if they're working. Are there anything, any numbers on lost productivity, which also means loss in revenue to this state? If you have any numbers about that.
I do. I just was doing a report that I'm going to present to a couple of insurers, and I'll give you those numbers. Mm-hmm. We figure 3.1 days per 100 annually lost due to illness for school children leaving, missing school, and 1.7 to 1.9 days missed work per 100 annually because of tooth infection and decay.
And then one more, Mr. Chair, please.
Follow-up.
I would imagine a child sitting in a school room with agony of toothache, which I've experienced myself, probably causes all kinds of other problems, not just with disruption in the room, but their ability to concentrate and learn.
We find learning problems. We find behavior problems. We find nutrition problems. We find problems with the willingness to go to school. We find esteem problems. And we find problems with other diseases associated with if a child is diabetic and has tooth decay, the infection can affect not only the diabetic and the healing process, but also the level of insulin necessary to care for the diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Other question? Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couple of questions, if I may. What is the scientific name for the fluoride that we're talking about being added to water?
There, fluorosilicin.
No,
it's in here.
It's in one of the copies.
It's in yours.
It's back here.
No. I didn't bring it with me. I did bring it.
Fluorosilicic acid.
Fluorosilicic acid? Okay. And if I may follow up, Mr. Chair, is that obviously that's not going to be considered a water soluble substance, though. It's going to be a fat soluble substance?
It's condensed, and then it is, the acid is condensed. And then it is put into the system as a solid.
So, if I may follow up, Mr. Chair. So it's added to the system as a solid, and then remains suspended after dissolution. Remains suspended in water as opposed to being.
The ions disperse 100% in throughout the water. During addition of to the water.
Okay.
So it stays in the water itself. That's correct, sir.
Okay. So then, and if I may, Mr. Chair, so then when it's ingested by a person and it goes through the physiologic processes, how is it, in other words, is it, will the level of fluoride then raise in the body, or will it, is what's not needed by the body excreted, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Some is excreted, some is maintained. It ties with calcium, so it deposits in bone, it deposits in teeth. Anything with calcium, there's a usual deposit with the fluoride, the binding of that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the effect. It affects both systemically, meaning within the bloodstream, and topically on the tooth itself when it is ingested with the water.
Okay, so that's what I'm getting at is that whatever is not utilized by the body. It's like taking a calcium tablet or taking a multiple vitamin or whatever. Whatever's not utilized by the body is sloughed off. You metabolize it through and you pee it out, or you Mr. Chair, you urinate it out, or you is excreted through your bowels.
Yes.
The point being that it does not raise to toxic levels in the body based on whatever is not utilized.
That's correct.
So in that respect, it's not necessarily a fat soluble substance either, because as we know, a lot of the fat soluble substances stressing that real fast, are the ones that tend to raise toxicity levels in the body, isn't that
vitamin
correct?
Vitamin A and vitamin D are two good examples of fat-soluble vitamins that taken in excess will become toxic.
Correct. Correct. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Representative, for clarification. Other questions? Representative Dinkfeld.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am curious for either of you to respond to this, is how other industrialized nations deal with this issue. Can you give me maybe a percentage of other nations, you know, similar to the U.S., whether or not they fluoridate their water? I do see that under national and international organizations, there's the British Medical Association.
I have that in the back in a big book. I could give that to you, but I have all the countries and how they, their populations and the percentage that they fluoridate their water and all of that. I have that for you if you'd like that. I can supply it to you. Right off the top of my head, I can't give you. It varies according to the countries that have natural fluoridation versus the country that do not. Western Europe tends not to, and they tend to fluoridate a little differently, I mean, as far as percentages, and I'll be glad to leave that with you if you'd like.
Thank you.
Representative Dalton.
Yeah, thank you. My question for the ODA is, do you have any information about allergies to fluoride or any sort of experience at the clinical level of sort of negative reactions when fluoride is either used or prescribed in treatment?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do have some information on that, and I think there's a statement, I could put my hands on it in the back of the room, that the there's a national association of, I believe it's physicians, whose specialty is allergy problems, and they have not found a connection of allergic reactions to water fluoridation, to the fluoride that's used in optimal water fluoridation. I can supply that to the committee.
Thank you, Representative. That's an area that the chair was checking on with the OMA as we're in progress here.
Well, I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman, because that had been expressed as a concern to me, and so you know, I started to try to sort of research that, and what I was coming up with were some studies that bore out what Ms. Meyer said. But you know, I'm curious if there's a body of literature out there that has a different conclusion.
Well, living with a lady who has a history of some significant allergy problems, chair is very sympathetic with allergy issues, and it's certainly one that I will need to have clarification on for my comfort level. Other questions from?
Thank you, and we'll leave that information with you before we go. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. May I ask another question? Thank you. Before you go, can you give us an idea of, there are a lot of products on the market today that have fluoride added. You know, Crest kind of comes to mind, as do several other particular tooth products that are out there, as well as mouthwashes and that sort of thing. For the moment, considering those, even though, and I recognize that absorption starts in the mouth, but recognizing that, I guess that could be considered a topical application, I mean, for argument of lack of a better way of putting it, but with the recognition of absorption starting in the mouth. What is the efficacy of those types of products versus the adding of fluoride into the water? In other words, can you get the same kind of efficacy, or is it better to have the product taken internally?
I think efficacy and efficiency are two things you've got to look at. Number one, water fluoridation touches everyone because it is in the water. It is for children. It is for adults. Many people don't have access to fluoridated toothpaste, even though that sounds silly. A lot of people can't afford fluoridated toothpaste. Many people can't even afford a toothbrush. Also, the issue of the application versus the water fluoridation, it has a halo effect. In other words, if a community like Portland would fluoridate their water, the effect would be greater than the community itself because of the bottled fruit juices and waters that were developed in the city of Portland would be consumed outside of that basic area. So that helps, plus the effect of the topical aspect is usually generated in a dental office if a child has specific needs. It is not a routine. If a child has braces and they need the topical fluoridation to stop the fluorosis of the braces on the teeth, if a person is noticing an excessive amount of decay, usually fluoride will be prescribed. But normally the fluoridation, the efficacy is much greater in the water than in the applications themselves.
Okay. And one follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. With regards to, you made a comment that kind of struck me, and that is with regards to products, for example, juices and sodas and that sort of thing that are developed in the city or bottled in the city, it would go out of the city. So that does bring up the issue of industrial uses. So if you have a business that is water sensitive, I mean, from the standpoint that they've got to have a clean, constant, reliable water source available for them to carry on their business, will fluoride affect that at all, or would it cause them to need to pre-treat their water? I'm thinking like there's a company in Tualatin called Fujimi America, and their product is scrubbing CD type of discs, and their water quality was extremely important, and that's one of the reasons why they moved out of Wilsonville. But they needed a very clean, reliable source, and at the time Wilsonville was drawing from wells, so they couldn't provide it. I'm just curious about that with regards to the fluoride. Would anything like that?
I know of none, but let's get you the answer. I'm not familiar with the company. I know that in dental offices, they use a water system where they need very pure water at the chair, and they treat their own water to specifically not get it out of a municipal system. But I will tell you that I know of no systems that require a scrubbing of that, but we will get you that information to make sure I'm correct in that. Because I don't know, it doesn't mean enough.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Dalto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, one thing that had been in my mind the past couple of days was, the prevalence of fluoridated water in a system. So, for example, you know, you have you take the fluoridated water in as drinking water, but you might go to a restaurant, you might have meals prepared with water that might contain fluoride, and all the other places where you might get fluoride from. How does that commercial preparation or food service preparation using water affect fluoride? Does it do anything? This soup made with water that contains fluoride, for example, does that affect the chemical process at all?
Does it break the fluoride down?
Yeah.
Does it eliminate it?
Yeah.
No, it doesn't. It stays in the system, and it will benefit it, just like the halo effect. Vegetables grown within a system that has fluoride and eaten outside that system will benefit the people outside that system somewhat, but it's not as efficient and effective as water fluoridation.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much
for your time this afternoon. There's some information you've been asked for. You'll get us that.
We will.
Appreciate it very much. At this point, we have Ken Strobeck hitting cleanup for the League of Oregon Cities. Oh, and Greg Baker is here for the special districts.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, could we also ask Mike MacArthur from the counties to come up, since they represent some water system providers as well?
We would agree to that.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ken Strobeck. I'm with the League of Oregon Cities. And I first want to say thank you for the invitation to speak to you today about this issue. And I'm representing our water policy expert, Willie Tiffany, who is ill today, called in very sick this morning, so normally I would be just introducing Willie and then let him run with the ball, but instead I'm going to do it for you today myself.
I hope he left you a well-prepared document to go from.
What I will do, Mr. Chair, with your permission, is just kind of abbreviate my testimony, because this is a committee that is made up of a number of veteran legislators, so we don't have to really start at ground zero with this committee. As you know, the principle of local control is one that's very jealously guarded by cities in Oregon, and the League of Oregon Cities as the representative. Cities are, of course, subject to the Constitution and statutes passed by the legislature, but the principle of local control, local decision-making, is one that that we protect very much and feel very strongly about. We also, as you know, are very concerned about finances at the local level, at cities. You know, there's a lot of talk in the Capitol this session about a spending cap for the state, and I'm here to tell you that cities are already operating under a spending cap created by Measure 5 and Measure 47 and 50, where we have a cap that costs, or that the taxes, property taxes, can go up no more than 3% a year. And so that means with costs associated with personnel, raw materials, and other items going up at a far greater rate, we have to do something every year to economize. Something has to stay, something has to go. And were you to add a mandate that we had to supply fluoride in water systems, that would be another cost item that that currently is not part of our local budgets on all cities. Water services are one of the most expensive services that cities provide. Many cities, as this committee knows, are being required to replace or upgrade their water systems at very high cost. Water rates in some communities have had to skyrocket because of mandated requirements for improvement. And it's true that water funds are operating as an enterprise fund in cities, meaning they're not part of the general fund, so they have to pay for themselves. So this could potentially mean an increase in rates to water customers. Now, water fluoridation is a controversial idea in Oregon. I think it's something like general sales tax or self-service gas. It's one of those issues that generates a lot of emotion on both sides of the issue. When we have had city council meetings where the issue of fluoridation of water supplies has come up, you get very strong emotional testimony on both sides of the question. And we think that is a good debate to have at the local level, where citizens have the access to the decision makers and can make their feelings heard. And as you heard earlier, the city of Beaverton had an advisory vote on water fluoridation last year, and it was passed by the citizens there, and they did go ahead and fluoridate their water system. But again, this was after a vote of the people there who decided that this is something that they wanted for their community. There's an old saying that goes, you attract more flies with honey than with vinegar. And of course, then there's the other observation that says, who wants to attract flies anyway? But that's a different issue. So if the state or the Dental Association, for example, would want to have more fluoridated water systems in Oregon, we think it's a far better idea to set up a program to provide the funding for that, not only for the investment in the fluoridation equipment, but also for ongoing operations as an incentive for communities that want to participate and whose citizens, like the city of Beaverton, have gone on the record to request it, or provide free fluoridating tablets to parents. Either of those options would accomplish the goals of this bill, which is a fluoridated water supply system, but without running into the issues of local self-determination in cities, as well as the costs associated with that. Now, speaking of costs, in terms of the potential costs of House Bill 2025, we believe this issue is as cloudy as a glass of unfiltered water. Water systems across the state vary in their makeup and will require different levels of investment. Most of the cost differences revolve around how many injection points will have to be located within the system for fluoridation to be effective. And, for example, Lebanon and Pendleton are two cities of comparable size. However, because of their system makeup, the costs would be very different. Lebanon has implemented a fairly inexpensive fluoridation system, $80,000 with only one injection point. And Pendleton, however, on the other hand, has a much more complicated system, which would require 8 injection points and the cost for Pendleton would undoubtedly be much greater. So it's very hard to just make an apples-to-apples assessment. For the committee's information, I did attach some research material that was done in 2001 that Willie provided for a bill that was introduced in that session, Senate Bill 99, which is very similar to the bill you have before you today. And we have some pretty different numbers from the numbers that, you heard from some of the earlier witnesses. As you can see, in 2001, then the state's incorporated communities of over 10,000 citizens had fluoridated water. And by contrast, about 1.5 million citizens were in incorporated cities over 10,000 with no fluoride additives. The study that was done for this 2001 bill by the firm of Black & Veatch estimated of the 33 cities at that time that did not fluoridate their water systems, that their estimate was that it would cost about $19.5 million for the initial equipment to provide fluoridation for the water supply system. That's only the equipment to inject the fluoride. That's not the ongoing annual cost of fluoride. While that analysis took into account incorporated cities over 10,000, there are also special water districts, which you'll hear about in a moment, and over 10,000 multiple communities with populations over 10,000. So under the terms of Senate Bill 99 from 01, those systems would have been reimbursed for the cost of installing fluoridation systems, which would increase the cost estimate. And again, I apologize that we haven't had time to get this research done for the impact of House Bill 2025. However, we believe those estimates would be more costly than they were in 2001. For example, the city of Salem recently replaced their fluoridation system in 2002. The cost for the city of Salem alone was $2.1 million, so I think that calls into question that figure of $2.8 million that you were given for an entire implementation statewide. The startup costs in the city of Beaverton were about $900,000, and just in terms of fairness relating to this bill as well, if the bill was passed, and cities that did not have fluoridated water systems received payments from the health division to start them up, I would think there would be several of the communities that have already gone out and invested multiple millions of dollars that would like to come back and get cost reimbursement from the state for those systems as well, since they have already gone ahead and done that. So our position is in opposition to this bill as it's currently drafted, not in opposition to fluoride specifically, but the fact that it does remove the local decision-making component and does provide additional expenditures for citizens of cities across Oregon. Strips Oregon citizens of their basic right to make this decision on a local level, and so that's why at this point, given the cost and the local control issues involved, we would be in opposition to House Bill 2025. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Just kind of one question. I do appreciate, you know, the comments you're making, Mr. Strobeck, on the costs and the local control, but for those cities that, you know, let's take a hypothetical type of thing, cities have the option of either doing this or not doing it. For those cities then that don't do it, should the state be able to send them a bill for the additional cost of the Oregon health plan for the additional dental care that and other things that are necessary for the people there in their communities and outside of them?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that there are probably thousands of decision points that you could say are things that are done well and things that are not done well for the benefit of a particular group of citizens, and I don't think it would be appropriate to single this particular one single item out and say if you're not fluoridating water, then you have to pay some sort of a fee for the impact. There are, again, decisions that are made on a community by community basis that I think need to be honored.
Well, certainly, I do respect that, but I think the issue gets a little bit complicated when we do recognize that there is a at least if what we're being told so far is correct, a rather significant additional cost to the state of Oregon in terms of the Oregon Health Plan, and of course then to the citizens of the state in terms of additional those who do not fall on the Oregon Health Plan. But those are the questions, I guess, that we need to wrestle with as we proceed through this.
Mr. Chair, if I could just respond to that. I think that, there are many decisions that are made about the benefits of living within a city, whether people are safer from crime because of police protections or whatever. And, this is really getting to a very detailed level of what's the responsibility of a community. I don't disagree with you that there should be some rewards and incentives, but again, that's where I was saying that the appropriate way to handle an issue like this would be to put up some funding and then say offer it to cities that wanted to take advantage of it and let them respond in a positive manner.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Kent. Mr. Baker, Greg Baker?
Yes, Chairman Jensen, members of the committee, happy to be here today. Special Districts Association represents over 800 units of local government to provide a wide variety of services. And about 100 of those are water district suppliers. As with Ken, I won't go over my written testimony in detail, but basically those 100, House Bill 2025 would impact 10 of those districts, and at 10 of our districts that currently don't provide, would under this bill, it appears that 7 with Sunrise Water District, if they do partial fluoridation now, is along with Palm Valley Water and South Suburban and Salem, do provide some level of fluoridation to their communities at this time.
Mr. Chair, may I just clarify that?
That's awkward.
Thank you. There's a fluoride in the water already coming out of the well, and they have to adjust, lower it to mix it in to bring it down low enough.
So. Then there would be 2 districts actually providing affirmative fluoridation, at least 10. So this bill would affect 8 of them at this point, and plus Palm Valley Water, I believe, to the majority of their district patrons, does not fluoridate. I believe a portion of that is in Beaverton. But anyway, historically, this issue has come up, and the position of Special Districts Association has been, as Ken has indicated, one, and the cost of covering capital expense and annual operating expense as a state mandate to local government should be covered by the state, as well as the issue that this is a contentious issue in many of the districts, and I'm sure they want local participation and have received local participation in terms of comments from the public in the past. So I think it's important to have that local debate as well. At this time, we have not taken an official position. We're somewhat on the fence. We would take some time to go back to these 10 districts and get some board comments as well as from their management. And if the committee wanted to so direct us to do that, we'd try to get you the results. We're pretty sure at this point in time that you'll get a mixed result based upon the history of this issue. Like I said, there's strong feelings on both sides of the issue, and the results are somewhat cloudy, and I think that reflects the progress on this issue in the past.
Thank you. Questions? Please.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, I'm Mike MacArthur, Executive Director of the Association of Counties. Counties in general are not in the business of providing water services. There are a few special cases where counties are involved in actually direct water system delivery. And I think the place where this would most impact counties is at the public health department level, where counties regulate and monitor through their public health departments the water supply. So adding fluoride to the water and then having to monitor that additional element of the water would potentially add cost to the testing processes that counties are involved with. So I think although our association has not taken a official position on this bill, I would concur with the principles that Mr. Strobeck has outlined here in the basic position that better off letting this be a local option, although there appears to be some benefits in fluoride, there is also additional costs involved with that, and given the situation that we find ourselves in at the state level, adding additional costs at this point might be difficult to accommodate. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Other questions? I got off easy.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And at this point, we have Lynn Campbell, the Executive Director of Oregon City's Citizens. Excuse me, Oregon City's Oregon Citizens for Safe Drinking Water. Good afternoon, Lynn.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Campbell. I'm Director of Oregon Citizens for Safe Drinking Water at P.O. Box 1045, Lake Oswego, Oregon 97034. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for inviting me today to come and talk to you, not about the bill, but about issues surrounding water fluoridation. I did bring a notebook of documents that I might ask, if they're available, that you look at a particular tab, because we find it's very helpful to look at documents. I'm also wanted to let you know that I'm bringing to the table, although you don't see him, Dr. William Hersey, who is the Senior Vice President of the Union of Scientists and Other Professionals at EPA headquarters, who I understand will be contacting by phone and he'll be able to speak to you by phone. And I would urge the members of the committee and the chair. Yes?
Excuse me just a minute, please.
Lynn, do you want me to try and call him
first
now before 2:30? Do you think he'd be at his phone?
I do.
Or do you want to testify?
I would prefer that he testify first, if that's all right with the committee and chair.
That's fine. Please, we'll take a brief pause while we try to make our phone connection. Representing Bob Jensen, Chair of the House Water Committee here in the state of Oregon, we certainly welcome you with us and proceed with your testimony. And then as there are questions, it may be hard for you to hear, so I'll relay them back to you when we have questions.
Great. Thank you very much, Chairman Jensen. Members of the committee, my name's William Hersey, and I'm Vice President of National Treasury Employees Union Chapter 280. That's the union that represents the professional employees at EPA headquarters here in Washington, D.C. I'm also senior scientist in the Risk Assessment Division in the Office of Pollution Prevention and Toxics at EPA headquarters, but I'm here giving this testimony as an official of the union and not as a representative of the agency. It's important for me to make that distinction. The views I'm presenting are those of the union, and they may not necessarily comport with those that EPA may hold on this issue. I'm sorry that I am not able to be there in person. I didn't find out about this until late Friday, and so I couldn't make arrangements to be out there. And I appreciate the opportunity to be able to give this testimony by telephone. The EPA headquarters professionals, including myself and the rest of the union membership, what we do is to assess the scientific, economic, engineering, legal information that's in existence, and then we develop policy options for the agency's political leadership to use in establishing regulations to protect the environment and public health in the nation. Our union may be considered somewhat unconventional in that we do not limit our activities to the usual collective bargaining issues that other labor organizations do. We organized in the first place in the early 1980s to protect EPA's environmental professionals' ability to do their job in as much of an ethical environment as possible, free from undue political influence. And we take that position out of loyalty to our civil service oath, which is pretty much the same oath that the military takes, which is in relevant part to support and defend the Constitution. of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. On all those occasions when an employee's come to the union complaining that management has exerted some pressure on them to circumvent environmental laws to achieve some preconceived political outcome, the union has stepped in and gone to bat for the employee. We believe in that case, when management does that sort of thing, it's an assault on the very constitutional process that we're sworn to defend. In the case of EPA's drinking water regulations on fluoride was a prime case in point. Those regulations were set in the middle 1980s not to comport with the mandates of the Safe Drinking Water Act, rather they were set to support water fluoridation. There's a very important point to be made about the EPA drinking water standards, by the way. EPA contracted with the National Research Council of the National Academy of Sciences about 2 years ago to review the most recent science on fluoride toxicity, and the report of that committee is due within a couple of months. The issue that you all are considering right now is of such importance that I think it would be a very unwise to proceed with a mandate on for fluoridation in Oregon before that committee completes its work and you have a chance to study its outcome. I think there's going to be some very interesting changes in the points of view about fluoride toxicity when that report comes out. We in the union really never had a dog in this fluoride fight until an employee came to us in 1984 and saying that his management was in effect ordering him to lie about the science as he was drafting the EPA primary drinking water standards for fluoride. And over the years, since that time, we've come to learn a lot about the heavy pressure at all levels of government to continue justifying putting fluoride in drinking water. Ever since 1984, our union has been studying the science behind fluoridation, including its risks and benefits, and we've come to the conclusion that it's not a good public policy. Before I get into the specifics of why our union opposes drinking water fluoridation, I'd like to pose a couple of questions that I would hope you would ask yourselves and also ask proponents of fluoridation before you move forward on this. And these are the questions. First of all, is there even one scientifically valid double-blind study showing that ingesting hydrofluosilicic acid, and that's the agent actually that's used in most fluoridation systems, showing that ingesting that agent is either safe or effective when fluoride level reaches one part per million and reducing dental caries incidence in humans? Is there one such double-blind study? If so, produce it. Secondly, how much economic benefit will the phosphate industry realize by disposing of some of its waste in Oregon? And how much money has the industry contributed to the campaign to use Oregon as a dump site for this waste? By the way, currently the nationwide figure for economic benefit to the phosphate industry is in the tune of about $130 million annually. And this is the third question is an extremely important point. And if you don't remember anything of my testimony, please remember this. Human breast milk contains, on average, about 0.01 part per million of fluoride. Even when the mother is consuming fluoridated drinking water with 100 times more fluoride in it than that. Now, why is it that our species has evolved a mechanism to filter out fluoride from human infants' first food supply? And what is the effect on an infant's developing brain and other organs of a 100-fold overdose of biologically active fluoride? Fourth, why is the dental health of third world nations, whose citizens don't consume refined sugar and flour, as good as or better than ours? You can go to the World Health Organization database on dental health and find those figures, by the way. And the same thing is true of Europe. Five, how long would a physician in Oregon keep his or her medical license if he or she prescribed a drug for all of his or her patients to take without asking any medical histories of the patients, without any control over the doses that the patients would take and ordered this drug to be taken for the patient's entire lifetime. How long would a physician hold their medical license if they did that? That's basically what fluoridation is. 6, dental fluorosis, which I talk about a little bit later, is an epidemic in the U.S., and at least a quarter of all U.S. children now have dental fluorosis on at least 2 teeth, and the proportion is much higher in fluoridated communities. The question is this: what increase in the prevalence of dental fluorosis would you be content to see among Oregon's children? And how much does the Oregon dental community charge to repair teeth that are damaged by dental fluorosis? 7, dental health is much more correlated with adequate access to dental health professionals than it is to fluoride content of drinking water. What fraction of Oregon's dentists accept welfare patients at all? And of those that do, what fraction of their practice is devoted to that clientele? And with those questions out of the way, our union's opposition to fluoridation is based principally on 2 points. First, it doesn't work as advertised as a dental health agent when it's ingested. And second, it poses unacceptable risks when ingested. These risks are cancer and gene mutations, toxicity to the brain, and I'll discuss each of these a little bit of detail in the limited time that I have here in a few minutes. Toxicity to bone and to teeth, toxicity to endocrine function, and there's toxicity of contaminants such as arsenic, lead, and mercury in the fluoridation chemical. And there are some other points to be made against the practice as well. For instance, the unethical nature of mass medication via drinking water, where dose control is absolutely impossible, and sensitive subpopulations are vulnerable to significant adverse effects, and they seem to be just lost in the shuffle. People, for instance, with kidney problems and others. Regarding the efficacy issue, the very best scientific study ever done on effectiveness of water fluoridation was run by the National Institute of Dental Research, part of the National Institute of Health, published in 1990, and what it showed was a statistically insignificant difference of 6/10 of a tooth surface saved out of a total of 128 tooth surfaces in the mouth if a child lived in a fluoridated community as opposed to an unfluoridated community. That's the best study ever done. 39,000 children run in a study done by the U.S. government. The longest-running two-city comparative study of fluoridation involves Kingston, New York, and Newburgh, New York. Kingston is not fluoridated, Newburgh is. The latest data published on that experiment in 1998 show Kingston, the unfluoridated community, actually has a slightly better dental caries rate than the fluoridated community. It's also not statistically significant. The only significant difference there actually is that the fluoridated community has almost twice as much dental fluorosis as the unfluoridated community. And it's not really hard to find newspaper articles telling the stories of large cities such as New York, Boston, and San Francisco that are in the midst of dental crises, even though these cities have been fluoridated for decades. Proponents of fluoridation gloss over the source of fluoride used in almost all the fluoridation systems in the U.S. The impression is that fluoride that gets into drinking water is some sort of pharmaceutical-grade material like in toothpaste, but that's very far from the truth. In fact, it's a waste product of the phosphate fertilizer industry. And even the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention admits that 90% of the arsenic found in fluoridated surface water systems, in fact, comes from this fluoridating agent. And the amount of arsenic on average in that material is enough when diluted in the normal fashion in fluoridation systems to cause 20 to 25 extra lung or bladder cancer cases in a million population. That translates to 75 to 90 cases for Oregon, considering the population of Oregon at 3.58 million people.
Mr. Chair?
James Hoffman.
Thank you.
Excuse me, sir. That's a question.
I would imagine
I would imagine the good doctor is going to back up all these statements with documentation.
Yes. I'd like to thank Lynn Campbell for preparing the written version of this testimony, in which there are some citations, and some of the material is covered in the citations. I could provide some of that material to you. I would very much love to be able to come out and appear in person and back all of this information up. I'm happy to do that if I get a chance to do that. Another very important point on the cancer issues, there was an epidemiology study completed in 2001 by Elise Bassin at the Harvard School of Dental Medicine that shows a sevenfold increase in osteosarcoma in young boys aged 6 to 10 years based on whether or not they lived in fluoridated communities. This is a new study and an extremely important one.
Thank you for allowing me to interrupt again, Mr. Chair, and with the doctor. I would appreciate if you would answer my question of if this is all so terrible, why do the United States Health and Human Services Department, the Center for Disease Control, every U.S. Surgeon General since the 1950s, and countless long lists of folks that study this ad nauseum, how can you explain to me, if it's so terrible, why these folks are in such great support of this idea?
Well, there are several reasons. Probably the simplest explanation is government hates to admit ever having made a mistake. So what you run into is that the government endorsed water fluoridation in the early 1950s before any of the studies that I'm referring to were completed, and declared it a safe and effective health measure, when in fact it was simply not proven. And then they promptly turned off all investigations into any adverse health effects and simply have said safe and effective, safe and effective, safe and effective. And nobody wants to admit now, after all this time, even in the face of all this new science that's been developed, even in the face of all the new science, how is it possible for these people now to step up to the plate? They're riding a tiger. They're going to step up to the plate and say, gee, you remember back in 1950 when we told you this was safe and effective? Well, guess what? It isn't safe and it isn't effective. Well, they're starting down that track. In 2001, in August 2001, the Centers for Disease Control finally admitted that the original theory behind the effectiveness of fluoride, namely that the stuff gets into the permanent teeth before they erupt, replaces hydroxide groups in the hydroxyapatite in the developing enamel and makes the developing enamel resistant to acid attack, that theory doesn't work. That in fact fluoride works topically, that is in high concentrations in toothpaste on the tooth surface, and it does not work systemically. So they're beginning to back away from that. The science as it's developing now on the these areas of toxicity is obviously scaring the bejabbers out of these folks. This latest piece from Harvard is an extremely important piece of work. The National Toxicology Program cancer study that was published in 1990 was an extremely important piece of work. That's also osteosarcoma in males. There are several other epi studies involving osteosarcoma showing elevated risk of osteosarcoma in males. The point is that government for a long time would not admit that they conducted these experiments on a black man in syphilis down in the South, that it conducted plutonium injection experiments at the University of Rochester that covered that kind of stuff up for years and years. Well, now we've got this national program of fluoridation, which is a house of cards about ready to fall. And I'm glad I'm not on the other side trying to defend this practice in the face of the growing mountain of science that shows it's neither safe nor effective. It is not a career-enhancing thing for a government person to step up to the plate and make a comment like that. Our union treasurer, Dr. William Marcus, who also happened to be the senior toxicologist in the Office of Drinking Water, was fired because he refused to basically keep his mouth shut about this National Toxicology Cancer Study that was published in 1990. He was fired, but sued the agency and was reinstated after the administrative law judge basically found that the agency had trumped up evidence, and the ALJ said that when he was really fired because of his position on fluoride. But that, the point of it is, those of us who, we didn't have, as I said before, a dog in this fight. We didn't care one way or another about fluoride. We didn't, when I first heard about this, I thought, well, fluoride, yeah, that's great stuff for your teeth. Went to a seminar, started hearing this stuff as an open-minded scientist, and it became very scary to learn this kind of information. And frankly, I have not. I have a still, you know, a countertop still, and I distill all of my water. My son, nor my wife, nor myself drink any fluoridated water. I try to avoid this stuff. But I've kind of departed from my prepared testimony, but you're getting the gist of it. There's, in addition to the cancer issue, the thing that really scared me more than anything in recent times is the information that's come in on neurotoxicity, the effect of fluoride on the brain. There's studies in humans and animals that are very, very disturbing. There's studies from China that show depression of children's IQs in areas of higher fluoride exposures compared to areas of lower fluoride exposures. There's animal studies showing that prenatal exposure at some critical points in gestation gives rise to birth of offspring that are hyperactive, and they remain hyperactive throughout their life. There's another animal study that used the same dose levels as that one I just mentioned that shows reductions in some critical brain chemicals as a result of fluoride exposure that seem to explain this hyperactivity response. There's still another study, which is the scariest one of all to me, in which animals were given one part per million fluoride and suffered substantial brain damage and also damage to the kidney. There's another brain effect, which also actually gets into the endocrine function issue, showing that the fluoride accumulates in the pineal gland, which is in the brain. The gland produces two important neurotransmitters, melatonin and serotonin. And melatonin serves as a biological clock, if you will. And premature reduction of melatonin produces premature sexual maturity. This has been shown in animal experiments. And in fact, was an effect similar to that was observed in this Kingston in Newburgh, New York comparative study. The first data set published on that experiment in 1956 showed that girls in the fluoridated community were began menstruation about 6 months earlier than the girls in the non-fluoridated community. In conclusion, this sort of winds up things here. My advice, our advice to you is not only to refuse to require Oregon citizens to swallow this toxic waste of the fertilizer industry, but you ought to stop the practice in the communities where it's now occurring. And at minimum, you ought to stop it until this National Research Council review of the most recent toxicity literature is completed. There's no downside risk to a moratorium. Studies in the peer-reviewed dental literature show that after stopping fluoridation in Canada, Cuba, Germany, and Finland, dental caries rates continue declining, as they have all over the world, by the way, over the last three or four decades. It's a matter of improved nutrition and access to dental care. If you really want to improve the dental health of Oregon citizens, our advice is don't add toxic waste to your water supply. Get the soda and candy machines out of your public schools. Beef up education on dental hygiene, and above all, improve access to dental professionals for all of your citizens. That pretty much concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to take any questions, and I thank you again for the opportunity to make this presentation.
Raphael Connell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Hoosey, I have a number of questions for you, but you mentioned that the phosphate industry would benefit from the from fluoridating the water. Can you help me understand why it is that the phosphate industry would benefit from this?
Yes, the chemical that's used in 90 to 91% of all the fluoridation systems in the U.S. is hydrofluosilicic acid, or the sodium salt of that substance. Where that material comes from is from the scrubbers in the phosphate, superphosphate manufacturing plants. When they grub up the phosphate rock and they process it, hydrofluoric acid and silicon tetrafluoride are some of the byproduct gases that come off. And those, if they are released into the atmosphere, are nasty air pollutants. So what they do is basically scrub those gases out with a water spray, collect the resulting solution, put it in a tank wagon. If they simply let that solution go out into the surface waters, discharged it into surface water, it would be a water pollutant. If they let the gases go out into the air, it's an air pollutant. We have a letter from Rebecca Hammer, by the way, is the Deputy Assistant Administrator for Water back in the 80s, saying essentially this very same thing, that EPA thinks it's a great idea to recover this stuff from the phosphate industry, because it would be an air pollutant if it gets in the air, a water pollutant if it gets in the water. They put it in a tank wagon and sell it to you guys for $360 a ton. It suddenly, magically, is not a pollutant anymore. They take it up to your water taps and bleed it slowly into your drinking water system, and by magic, it becomes not a pollutant. They also save about $1.40 a gallon in processing charges, which they would otherwise have to incur because it would have to be managed as a hazardous and toxic waste under RCRA rules. So they avoid having to deal with it as a hazardous waste. They get an economic benefit of about $360 a ton selling it to you. The net overall of 200,000 tons a year approximately across the country translates in somewhere in the range of $130 million a year every year that cash register brings for the phosphate industry. Pretty soon you're talking real money, $130,000 this year, $130 million, I'm sorry, next year, and pretty soon you're talking real cash. So one of the places I think where a lot of the financial backing for these campaigns to fluoridate massively in the U.S. is the huge economic advantage to the phosphate industry. In China, they don't do this. Much of that fluoride effluent from phosphate manufacturing is converted to aluminum fluoride and is used in aluminum manufacturing. So there are other ways to dispose of this stuff than putting it into drinking water systems.
Thank you.
Follow up.
Can you help me understand, maybe not quite as long an answer as the last one, but maybe can you help me understand how arsenic occurs in fluoridated surface water?
Sure. The arsenic is it naturally occurs in the crust of the earth and simply gets into the phosphate processing stream as this rock gets processed, and it's an unavoidable contaminant in that particular product. There are agents that could be used for fluoridation that are much lower in arsenic content than this stuff. And as I said, the average level is about 30 parts per million of arsenic. Some levels are higher, some levels are lower. It varies, obviously, depending on what the arsenic content of the ore that's being processed is. But on average, it runs around 30 ppm. And when you dilute that out, I didn't want to go into all the mathematics now. It gets down to about 100 parts per trillion in the water. And based on the science that EPA used in establishing its new maximum contaminant level for arsenic, which will take effect next January, by the way, using the science behind that arsenic standard, that translates out to about 20 to 25 extra lung and bladder cancer cases in a million population.
Okay. So, and one more follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So you're also arguing that earlier testimony from one of our dental folks was making the case that fluoride is actually excreted from the body. Whatever's not utilized by the body is excreted as opposed to being held by the body. And what I hear you arguing is that toxicity levels do go up because it in essence is not excreted from the body but is held by the body and therefore can reach toxic levels. Is that correct?
Humans absorb, adults absorb about 50% of an ingested dose. About 50% of it is retained in the body, principally in what's called calcifying tissue, such as bone and ligaments and the like. In children, children retain much more than 50%. Children retain up to about 80% of an ingested dose. Not all of it is excreted by a long shot. And like I said, in adults, about 50% is excreted and about 50% is retained in the bones.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Then, so if it's retained in the bones, I'm assuming that it's retained there because it's needed as opposed and it's used by the bone as opposed to being retained there just to sort of sit there and raise toxic levels. You're kind of arguing both sides here.
No, it's not retained because it's needed there. It's retained because of what it does is replace hydroxy groups in the hydroxyapatite structure. In fact, there are a substantial number of epidemiology studies, and again, in the printed version of my testimony that Lynn Campbell has been able to distribute, you'll see a number of studies that show increased bone fracture rates as the fluoride level increases in bone. There's an exceptionally good study published on a valley down in Mexico where there's substantial dental fluorosis. And there's unfortunately beautiful dose response curves for both adults and children showing as dental fluorosis increases, and dental fluorosis is a good index of exposure. As dental fluorosis increases, you get this beautiful straight line increase in bone fracture rate. So while the fluoride goes into the bone, it in fact produces weaker bone, increases bone density. It was used as a early on as a therapy for osteoporosis because it was thought that because of the increasing bone density that this would strengthen bone, but it doesn't strengthen it. In fact, causes weaker bone even though the density goes up.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, but that argument doesn't quite make sense to me. I will need to go back and read these articles that you've referred to because when you increase bone density and then to say that you're causing bone weakness doesn't make sense unless you have a situation where you're getting an excessive hardening of the bone in which the marrow is then not functioning correctly. And given that kind of a situation where you've got your bone turning to what you're suggesting then is that the bone is turning to ivory as opposed to maintaining the canals and the marrow canals in the bone. So I'm having a hard time with your statement that you're making that you're while increasing bone density you're actually causing a weakening of the bone. I don't follow that.
The fact that bone density does not necessarily correlate with increasing strength. Increasing density does not necessarily mean increasing strength.
Okay. Representative Dalton.
By the way, Dr. Hersey, what's your degree in?
Chemistry. I have a PhD in chemistry from the University of Missouri.
Oh, have you had any work in, what's the body of science that does bones and bone density in that?
I'm sorry, I'm having a tough time hearing you.
Yeah.
Have you had any work in the area of the bone and bone density?
I was just trying to understand the basis for which you made your last comment. I wasn't sure if you were had a particular education in that.
No, it's simply in following the literature and, in fact, having the advantage of hearing seminars from Dr. Leonard Krug, who's a well-known scientist working in that field at Cornell who's done a great deal of work on bone strength and fluoride exposures.
Okay, well, thank you. Anyway, you know, I had a question. I went to my dentist a couple of years ago. I was having a problem with my teeth, and the dentist prescribed fluoride. Gave me a bottle of some kind of fluoride solution that I was supposed to, you know, use on a regular basis, and which I did. And I guess I had a question for you. Would you say then that a dentist who prescribes fluoride to a patient like myself is doing something that they shouldn't be doing? Now, I would go back to your statement of characterizing fluoride as toxic waste of the fertilizer industry. So, would you say that I was being prescribed toxic waste of the fertilizer industry by my dentist, out of curiosity?
No, I wouldn't. No, I wouldn't say that. But the fluoride that your dentist is applying to your teeth. First of all, I'm not a dentist and I'm not a physician. So, strongly believe that the fluoride that's being used in dental offices is in fact pharmaceutical grade fluoride, which is different from the chemical that's being put in fluoridation systems around the country. That's the important distinction to be made. The fluoride tablets that are prescribed by physicians and dentists and the fluoride treatments that are given in dental offices is a chemically pure pharmaceutical grade material. The stuff you want to put into the drinking water whoever it is that's pushing this out in Oregon wants to put in your drinking water system is far from the pharmaceutical grade material. It is, in fact, the toxic waste of the phosphate industry. The fluoride that's used topically in dental offices, in fact, works. It remineralizes incipient caries. It interferes with the metabolism of the bacteria in the mouth that produce acid and cause problems. I'm not arguing that all fluoride treatments are toxic or are a problem. It's the stuff that goes in the drinking water system that does not work as advertised.
Yeah, I think we understood what you were saying there, Doctor. One follow-up there, Representative Dalton.
Yeah. So, with your degree in chemistry, can you explain to me the difference between the chemical that is being applied to water systems and the chemical that's prescribed at a doctor's office? It's unclear to me the difference between what you're characterizing as pharmaceutical-grade fluoride and the toxic waste of the fertilizer industry.
Well, the material, I'm not sure precisely what the chemical is that's used in dental offices, but I suspect that it's probably some form of sodium fluoride or maybe monosodium phosphate of some kind, but that it is chemically pure, relatively pure. It does not have all of these byproducts in it, as does the material that comes from the scrubbers and the phosphate industry. I don't know how to explain it any simpler than
well,
that.
Well, maybe if you can just explain to me then why, if you don't know the chemical composition or what the pharmaceutical grade, the chemistry behind the pharmaceutical grade fluoride is, how can you even suggest to me that it's different than any other fluoride?
Well, I can tell you what's not being put in your mouth is hydrofluorosilicic acid, and I know that that's what's going into the fluoridation systems. I can tell you that for an absolute fact. That's what's going into the fluoridation systems. If you fluoridate in Oregon, the predominant chemical that's going to be used is going to come up in tank wagons from Louisiana or Florida, and it's going to be an acid solution of about 24% of hydrofluorosilicic acid. It's going to come laced with arsenic and lead and mercury, and that's what you're going to be putting into citizens' drinking water systems, and you're going to be causing 20 to 25 additional lung and bladder cancer cases for every million population that drinks that stuff. That's what you're going to do. And you better study the literature and do due diligence before you vote for that kind of thing.
Okay, Representative Schaffer.
Yeah. Thank you. And this is just a comment in general. If the doctor wants to respond to it, that's fine. But, you know, I'm confident the production of chlorine probably isn't a very pretty process either. I think the picture being painted here is that whatever this is being shoveled up off the floor of a chemical plant and thrown in a tank and then thrown in the water for all us and our children to consume. And I can't imagine that there isn't some kind of inspection process that goes along with the development and the processing and the distribution of this chemical into the water system. But I guess the comment I had to make is if you ingest any certain amount of chlorine, it is toxic as well. And if you emit a certain amount of chlorine, whether it be gaseous or liquid, into the ecosystem, I'm confident that's toxic and deadly as well. The point I think needs to be made here is chlorine is very carefully measured in very measured amounts and has benefited the medical the health of people that consume water in this country ever since we discovered it and found out putting it in. I think a very close parallel analogy can be put onto fluoride as well. And it's just some comments for they're just out there for people to think about. Yeah.
If I may respond to that, the chlorine is put into the water to treat the water. Chlorine is put into the water to kill organisms in the water that cause disease in humans. Fluoride, in the form of hydrofluorosilicic acid, is not put in to treat the water. It's put in to treat people. And there's a vast difference. There's also a vast difference in the purity of those substances. But chlorine has its own problems, but the analogy between fluorine and chlorine, even though they're both halogens in this case, is really not helpful.
Doctor, we're at the end of our time, so we want to thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Appreciate the written testimony that you have. We certainly will have more questions on this. Perhaps through Lynn we'll be able to get those questions to you and get some resolution.
Okay. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any written questions. I will appear before you tomorrow. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your taking the time today, Doctor. Lynn, a number of us on the committee have 3 o'clock engagements, and my question is it possible for you to return on Wednesday?
Yes.
Would that be too much of an imposition?
I was planning to come anyway. I wonder, could I ask members to bring the notebooks?
Oh, sure.
And could I make just a couple of suggestions?
We'll have had a chance, of course, by Wednesday to look through the materials, and that will be somewhat helpful to us, too, to keep ourselves focused a little bit. Thank you very much.
I really appreciate
you being here. Thank you. With that, my committee is ready to roll. We are adjourned.
Thank you.